If you work anywhere near automotive materials, you've almost certainly run into what I like to call the silicon wall.
Oh, absolutely. It's the classic headache. It just never goes away.
Right. You want that amazing high-strength steel. You need the trippy effect.
And for the trippy effect, you need silicon. It's the go-to ingredient.
And here's the wall. You also need to sell a car that isn't a pile of rust in 5 years. So you have to galvanize it.
And silicon just wrecks the galvanizing process. It's a disaster.
It floats to the surface, makes these awful oxides, and the zinc coating just, it won't stick. It's a complete engineering nightmare.
Which is exactly why the entire industry has been obsessed for years with finding a way around it. How do you get those fantastic mechanical properties without the one thing that makes the steel impossible to coat?
So today we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating piece of research that hits this problem head on. It's a master's thesis from Youngjo Choi at the Graduate Institute of Ferrous Technology.
And the solution isn't some minor adjustment. It's a whole new recipe.
It is. We're talking about taking silicon out and swapping it with aluminum.
High aluminum, 2RIP steel.
But as you know, in metallurgy, there's never a free lunch. You fix the rust problem, but you create, well, a new kind of chaos in the microstructure. This thesis found a glitch, a structure that, according to all our best models, just shouldn't be there.
They call it dendritic delta ferrite. And you're right to call it a glitch. I mean, if you pull up the equilibrium phase diagrams, the maps we use to predict what steel is supposed to do, this structure is a ghost.
It should be gone.
Long gone. It should have been completely consumed by other reactions way before the steel ever got to room temperature.
But it's not. It survived.
Yeah.
And today, we're going to figure out why. We're going to unpack non-equilibrium solidification, find out why the computer models got it so wrong, and why this zombie structure is actually the key to building safer cars.
It's a detective story, really. The crime scene is just, you know, a solidification front at 1500 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so let's start with the basics of this swap. We know why we want trip steel. That's transformation-induced plasticity.
The magic trick.
The magic trick. The steel gets stronger as you deform it, like in a crash.
Mm.
The retained austenite phase transforms into super hard martensite.
Correct. And that transformation literally absorbs energy. It stops the metal from thinning out and just snapping. Instead, it hardens up right where the stress is.
So silicon is what usually keeps that austenite stable and ready to go.
Oh.
But in this research, Choi uses aluminum instead. And we're not talking a tiny amount.
No, not at all. In most steels, aluminum is just a deoxidizer. You use trace amounts. Here we're looking at alloys with, what, 1.7 to 2.2 weight percent aluminum? That's a massive change to the chemistry.
And that huge chemical shift is what creates this delta phase in the first place.
Yes. So when this alloy is a liquid and it starts to cool, the very first solid crystals that form are this delta ferrite. And because they're growing freely in a liquid, they form dendrites.
Dendrites, which are basically little microscopic trees.
That's the perfect analogy. Picture a tiny little pine tree made of iron and aluminum just growing out of a pool of liquid metal. That's your delta ferrite.
Okay, now here's where the mystery begins. According to all the textbooks, those little trees are supposed to be temporary.
They're a transitional phase, right? And this is where we look at the equilibrium phase diagram. It's our roadmap. It tells you what state the metal wants to be in at any given temperature.
And Choi used the industry standard thermocalc with the TCFE6 database to plot this out.
And that map is very, very clear. As the temperature drops, say, below about 1300 Celsius, those delta ferrite trees are supposed to react with the liquid around them and completely transform into austenite.
100% transformation.
The calculation says there should be zero delta ferrite left. It should be totally gone, consumed. The final structure should be, you know, austenite and other things, but definitely not those original high-temperature trees.
But then Choi takes the actual piece of steel, the ingot, he cuts it, polishes it, sticks it under a microscope, and what does he see?
A forest. The dendrites are still there. Big, beautiful, stubborn delta ferrite trees.
That's a huge contradiction. The computer model, which is assuming perfect, slow equilibrium conditions, says 0%.
And the physical evidence says, nope, I'm still here.
So where do you even start with that? Do you just throw the model out?
Not right away. The first question is, why did the model fail? And equilibrium models, they assume that nature has all the time in the world to move atoms around.
But casting a piece of steel is not an infinite process. It's fast.
It's very fast. So Choi's first hypothesis was pretty straightforward. This has to be a kinetics problem. The steel cooled down so fast that the atoms just didn't have time to do the necessary rearranging to get rid of the ferrite. The reaction got cut off.
And to prove it, he did what's called the soaking experiment, which I love. It's such a simple, powerful idea.
It is. You basically take the steel with the wrong structure and you force it to find equilibrium. You give it the time it never had.
He puts the samples back in a furnace at 1300 degrees Celsius, right in that sweet spot where the transformation is supposed to happen.
And he just leaves them there for 24 hours.
An eternity in atomic terms.
Oh, it's forever. He did the calculations. He showed that 24 hours was more than enough time for all the manganese and aluminum atoms to diffuse and find their happy homes.
And the result?
The trees vanished. The delta ferrite was gone. It transformed into austenite, which then became martensite when it cooled. The final structure looked exactly like the equilibrium map predicted.
So that solves part one of the mystery. The delta ferrite isn't secretly stable. It's there because the casting process is a race, and the transformation reaction lost that race.
Exactly. The metal solidified before the job was finished, but that just leads to a much harder question.
Why did it lose the race so badly?
Right. And this is where the research pivots into solidification kinetics. It's not just if it survived, but how the cooling rate affects it.
This is where he starts measuring the little branches on the trees. The secondary dendrite arm spacing, or SDAS.
A classic measurement, yes.
And the rule is simple, right? The faster you cool, the smaller the spacing between the branches. The trees are finer.
Correct. They don't have time to grow these big, coarse arms. And Choi's experiments confirm that, but then he tried to simulate this using DIC Tray.
Okay, let's pause on DIC Tray. So thermocalc was a static map. DIC Tray is like a movie. It simulates diffusion. It simulates atoms moving over time. It should be able to handle the speed factor.
It absolutely should. That's what it's for. So he puts in the cooling rates, the chemistry. He's expecting the simulation to show that as cooling gets faster, more of that delta ferrite gets trapped.
But that's not what happened.
Not at all. The computer basically came back and shrugged. It predicted that the cooling rate would have almost no effect on the final amount of ferrite. It said, look, even at these speeds, the reaction should be fast enough. The ferrite should mostly be gone.
So now we have two failures. The static map failed, and the dynamic simulation also fails to match reality.
And the reality is stark. The real-world samples show that faster cooling means way more retained ferrite. The simulation says it shouldn't matter.
That's the critical point, isn't it? When your simulation fails that badly, it means the fundamental mechanism you programmed into it must be wrong.
It has to be. DIC Touré is assuming the transformation happens through diffusion, meaning atoms slowly moving through the solid material.
But Choi realized something else had to be going on. A shortcut.
A shortcut. And to understand it, we have to look at the paratectic reaction.
Okay, break this down for us. This is the reaction where the liquid plus the delta ferrite are supposed to turn into austenite.
Right. So in the textbook version, you've got your solid delta ferrite tree in the liquid. The austenite starts to form right on the surface of that tree.
It creates a shell, a skin.
Exactly. A solid shell of austenite forms around the ferrite. Now just think about what has to happen next. You have liquid on the outside, ferrite on the inside, and this solid wall of austenite in the middle.
So for the reaction to keep going, atoms have to somehow get through that wall.
And that is a massive traffic jam. Diffusion through a solid is incredibly slow. It's the bottleneck of the whole process. If that were the only way forward, it would take a very long time.
But Choi's thesis argues that in this high aluminum steel, the austenite finds a completely different path.
It's a mechanism called direct solidification. He proposes that instead of trying to slowly eat the ferrite through that diffusion barrier, the austenite just decides to grow directly into the liquid instead.
So it's not consuming the tree, it's just filling in the empty space between the branches.
Yes. And this is where the aluminum chemistry is the hero of the story. Remember, aluminum is a ferrite stabilizer.
It wants to be inside the ferrite crystal.
That's right. So as those initial ferrite trees grow, they're basically hoarding the aluminum from the liquid. But that changes the chemistry of the liquid right around them.
It makes the liquid tasty for austenite to grow in.
Perfectly put. The liquid gets enriched in austenite stabilizers like manganese and carbon. So you have this huge chemical incentive for austenite to form in the liquid. At the same time, the ferrite is so full of aluminum that the thermodynamic drive for the austenite to eat it is actually reduced.
So just easier for the austenite to grow out into the liquid. than it is to grow in and attack the ferrite.
It's the path of least resistance. It races outward, filling the gaps, and completely bypasses that slow, diffusion-based bottleneck.
And that explains why the cooling rate is so important.
How so?
Well, if growing into the liquid is a fast process and eating the ferrite is a slow process, if you cool everything down really quickly, the fast process wins. The liquid solidifies into austenite and locks everything in place before the slow process even has a chance to get going.
You've got it. The direct solidification wins the race and the cooling freezes the finish line. You're left with the original Delta ferrite skeleton, just encased in austenite, but it's totally untransformed.
And the DIC Trailia simulation failed because it was probably programmed to only model the slow diffusion-controlled growth. It didn't have a way to account for this faster competitive growth mechanism.
That's the conclusion, yes.
Yeah.
The simulation was waiting for the shell to thicken, while in reality, the metal was just filling in the gaps.
That is a huge insight for anyone actually trying to make this stuff, because this isn't some lab curiosity. If you're casting giant slabs of this steel for car carts, this zombie ferrite is going to be in there.
And it really, really matters. It's not just some inert filler material.
Why not? I mean, if the goal is a light, strong part, does a little bit of leftover ferrite really hurt?
It throws the whole balance off. The entire point of Tripasteel is the very specific stability of that retained austenite. You need it to be perfectly metastable.
The Goldilocks zone.
The Goldilocks zone. Stable enough to exist, but unstable enough to transform into martensite when you need it to in a crash. If you have all this delta ferrite taking up space, you're messing with the carbon distribution, which is the main stabilizer for austenite.
You could make the austenite too stable.
Right. So you get in a crash, and the metal just bends. The TRIP effect doesn't trigger.
Or it could be too unstable.
Exactly. It could transform while you're just stamping the door panel in the factory. Now you've got a brittle part before it even gets on the car.
And there's another place this gets really messy. Welding.
The heat affected zone. The HAZ.
Yeah, when you spot weld a car frame, you're essentially doing a tiny little casting experiment right there on the assembly line. You're melting the steel, and it's cooling down incredibly fast.
And you're replicating these exact non-equilibrium conditions. If your welding procedure doesn't account for this delta ferrite formation, your welds could have a totally different and maybe much weaker microstructure than the rest of the part.
You're creating brittle spots at every single joint. So Choi's thesis isn't just an interesting observation, it's basically a warning label for the industry.
It is. It's saying, if you're going to use high aluminum trip steel to fix your galvanizing problem, you have to master the solidification mechanic. You can't just rely on the old equilibrium charts.
You have to design your cooling rates, your casting speeds, your welding parameters, knowing that this ferrite is going to try and survive.
You have to manage the chaos, manage the non-equilibrium state.
It's so interesting how it always comes back to time. We think of material science as just chemistry, mix A and B. But in manufacturing, time is a physical ingredient.
It might be the most important one. The difference between a high-performance safety steel and a brittle piece of junk can come down to fractions of a second in cooling.
So we've solved it. The mystery of the zombie ferrite. It's a relic left over from a race between diffusion and direct solidification, all driven by the peculiar chemistry of aluminum.
And it really does shine a light on the limits of our current simulation tools. As we get into more and more complex alloys, these glitches are going to become the norm, not the exception.
We need models that can handle the chaos.
We do. We have to move beyond equilibrium thinking.
Before we finish, I want to leave you with one last thought. We spend so much effort in materials design trying to eliminate defects or imperfections. We want these pure, predictable structures. But in this case, the defect, this non-equilibrium structure, is an inevitable consequence of getting the benefit you want, the galvanizing.
It's a trade-off baked into the physics.
It makes you wonder what other zombie structures are hiding in the materials we use every day, waiting for just a slightly different manufacturing process to reveal themselves. Are we really designing materials from the ground up, or are we just getting better at managing their inevitable side effects?
Probably a little bit of both, but as long as we keep looking under the microscope, we'll keep figuring it out.
That's the hope. A huge thank you to the work of Youngju Choi for giving us such a fascinating puzzle to unpack. And thank you for listening.
Until next time.
Stay curious.